Okay, we're going to start our course in ethics now. We're going to be using Dr. Norman Geisler's textbook, Christian Ethics, Options and Issues. Now, if you look at the table of contents in his book, he spends an awful lot of time on ethical options. He's got 7 of 16 chapters on that. That's real tough reading, and we're going to cover those 7 chapters in the first 2 lectures. We're just going to breeze through that and just give you an overview on it. We're not going to get as in-depth on that. But what I'm going to focus on is the ethical issues. The abortion, euthanasia, and running down the line. And then I'll even throw in a couple other issues that he doesn't touch on in this textbook himself. Let me give you an overview first. If you want an overview, just jot down this as I say it. We're shooting for 12 lectures. We're probably going to end up with more. But the first lecture is going to be on what Geisler calls options. Or you can write it down as an introduction, but it's just some of the different ethical options that are discussed. The second lecture, we're going to refute moral relativism. Lecture number 3, we're going to discuss abortion. Lecture number 4, we're going to discuss euthanasia and infanticide. Euthanasia being mercy killing, and infanticide being the killing of babies that are already born. Whereas abortion, the babies are killed before they're born. Lecture number 5, biomedical issues. There's a whole lot of crazy things that are coming up now, like cloning and stuff, because of the technological advances. Just because man can do something doesn't mean that it's okay to do it. Lecture number 6, we're going to discuss sexuality. And we'll be covering homosexuality in that area as well. Lecture number 7, marriage and divorce. Lecture number 8, racism and ecology. Lecture number 9, government and capital punishment. You know, some people that teach that communism is the best form of government, and they try to base it on the Book of Acts and the early church. And I do not believe that they're interpreting the scriptures correctly. Lecture number 10, civil disobedience and revolution. By the way, some of these issues, like on revolution, and even civil disobedience to a certain degree, I have a few disagreements with Geisler. Not major differences of opinion, but I would be kind of in between Francis Schaeffer and Norman Geisler on some of those issues there. Lecture number 11, war, you know, the just war criteria, war and nuclear disarmament. Where should we as Bible believers stand on those issues? And then lecture number 12, the freedoms of speech and religion. And so we'll be discussing those. That's pretty much just an overview of the course. I don't know if we're going to get it in 12 lectures. We try to get, the Gospel of John in 16 lectures, and it took 28, so there's really no telling. We're going to try to keep it a little shorter. Brief introduction into this course, so it's not as brief as it should be, probably, but we're going to talk about different definitions of ethics. I believe Geisler covers it in his textbook. It's been years since I read it, but I believe that this is information. Yeah, this is information that he covers in the textbook. And so we're just going to go through that in a rather quick manner. By the way, if you know from my other courses, I almost ignore the textbook, even though I read it. And you get in the lectures, you get more of my own views or my own format. With Norman Geisler, he writes very well-organized books. And with this, not so much his Christian apologetics, but his philosophy of religion, his introduction to philosophy. When I teach courses from that, I come as close to teaching from a textbook as possible. And it's just some of my professors at Liberty University took more liberty with some of his textbooks, and I got learned more from reading his textbooks than I did from their lectures. So Geisler really keeps things well organized, and I don't like to fix something if it's not broken. Different definitions of ethics, and by ethics we're talking about it's that branch of philosophy that deals with what is right and what is wrong. Okay? That's all that we're talking about, issues of morality. But it is a branch of philosophy. One definition of ethics is that might is right. Might is right. And, it could be just five bikers that are on a street corner and the biker's got the biggest arms. He's always right because nobody wants to mess with him. Or it could be, whoever controls the military in a country. It might be whoever can sway the most people in that country because they're going to be able to have the most power. But whoever has the most power is right. That's the might is right view. The reputation of this is that one can be powerful but still be evil. Just because you're powerful doesn't make you good. Examples, Nero, Hitler, Stalin. These guys' names are usually viewed as being synonymous with evil, yet these guys had all the might you could possibly have in their domain. Second view is that morals are cultural mores, or basically cultural norms, or whatever your culture teaches you is right, The community decides what is right. The problem with this view is if this view is true, then one community cannot condemn another community. The American community cannot say that Nazi Germany was wrong to butcher 6 million Jews. Okay? So we see that, once you make the community the giver of the moral laws alone and no higher authority to appeal to, then you can't settle a dispute between two communities. Protagoras, an ancient Greek philosopher, he said man is the measure. Man is the measure. And he's basically teaching that each person determines what is right for himself. What is right for me is right for me. It doesn't have to be right for you and vice versa. And again, we bring into the picture Adolf Hitler to refute this, because if this is true, if man is the measure, if you decide what is right for you and no one else can tell you different, then how do you call the actions of Adolf Hitler wrong? How do you call the actions of Adolf Hitler evil? If man is the measure, then Adolf Hitler is the measure of what is right for him. And he felt that it was right, and it was the best thing to do was to kill 6 million innocent Jews. The human race is the basis of right. The human race. So now we say, well, we can judge Adolf Hitler because remember the Nuremberg trials where the rest of humanity, civilized humanity, got together. And of course, somebody's got to define what civilized means. The rest of humanity gets together and sits in judgment. So the human race is the basis of what is right. The human race as a whole decides what is right. Refutation of this is that the world has been wrong in the past and it can be wrong now. There was one time where the consensus of the human race was that the world is flat. Well, they were wrong. The world was never flat. It was also the consensus of the world that slavery is right. It was only recently that Western civilization felt guilty about slavery and put a stop to it. Until that point, that was just a normal part of life. You were going to have your slave masters and your slaves, and if your dad owed some money to some guy, he became his slave. So that if he didn't pay off the debt and you were born into that family, you then became that guy's slave. Yeah.
Wasn't it about 15 years after the Civil War that our Supreme Court finally changed its ruling on slavery? Do you agree with
that? The Emancipation Proclamation, I know when Lincoln came up with that, what was that, in 1863? 1863, I know that that proclamation. claimed that they were free, but I think it took the winning of the Civil War to enforce it. But if you're talking about the Dred Scott case, there the decision was something like blacks were something like 3/5 of a human being, something really, really unfortunate. And that's a good case to refer to when people say that that abortion is right because the Supreme Court says it's right. Well, the same Supreme Court also at one time said that blacks were only a fraction of a real human being. And so obviously if they were wrong then, they could be wrong now. But the human race, as far as being the basis of what is right, the world can be wrong, even if the whole world was in agreement, and you could take a vote of all mankind or all the different nations. There was a time when they thought slavery was all right. In fact, there's countries now that still practice that. There's some that believe that what is right is moderation. As long as you don't go from one extreme to another, that is what is right. Sometimes, moderation is often the best course to take. Sometimes you got this guy, this preacher, and he's saying, look, anytime somebody does something wrong, it's a demon's fault. And then a guy on this other side, another preacher says, no way, it's never a demon. It's always our own sinfulness. It's never a demon that ever gets involved. You see, there they're taking two opposite extremes, and there's probably a more moderate road to take. That, yes, most of the time it's our sinfulness, but that doesn't mean that demons can't get involved in the picture and influence us and tempt us to do evil. So moderation is often the best course to take. However, there are also times when the right thing to do is extreme. If some guy pulls out a machete and starts chasing after your wife, to take a moderate position there is not the best thing to do. The best thing to do at that point would be to tackle that guy and try to get that machete out of his hands. So self-defense. Sometimes war, when your nation is being invaded by a nation that wants to enslave your people, moderation is probably not going to be the best resource to take. An emergency rescue. Somebody's drowning and you're a great swimmer and you have the ability to save them, taking a more moderate view probably is not going to be best. So moderation is often the best course to take, but it is not always the right course. It is not synonymous with the right. Right is what brings pleasure. Right is whatever brings the most pleasure. That's another view. The Epicureans in the 4th century B.C. held to this view, and Paul dealt with them and the Stoic philosophers on Mars Hill in the book of Acts. Although what they viewed as pleasure, they've gotten a bad rap, because really what they viewed as pleasure was more of the peaceful life. So they weren't really, the strict Epicureans were not the kind of guys that were getting heavy into sexual immorality and stuff like that. There was more moderation in their type of pleasure. But what Epicureanism has degenerated into is basically hedonism. Whatever brings pleasure is right, whatever brings pain is wrong. If it feels good, do it. And that joke often comes up where one guy got fired from his job, his wife left him, he was in debt, his whole life was falling apart. And so he just figured, I'm just going to go for a drive, and he gets stuck in traffic, and he gets stuck behind a guy at a red light, and the light stays red for a real long time, and he's all ticked off, and he looks at the guy's bumper sticker, and the bumper sticker says, if it feels good, do it. So he figures, hey, why not? Everything else is going bad, and puts the thing at the drive, and slams on the gas, and slams the back of the guy's car, and the guy comes out all upset, and he tells him, well, it felt good. Now, I don't think that's a true story. I hope not, but the point is well taken. Even the people who say, if it feels good, do it, would not be telling that type of thing to a Charlie Manson or an Adolf Hitler if they were standing there with a guy with a machete in their hands. So right is whatever brings pleasure. Hedonism, what brings pleasure is right, what brings pain is wrong. Refutation of that is that not all pain is bad. Ask these bodybuilders. You don't get big without a certain amount of pain. You don't get big muscles without a certain amount of pain. That's why they say no pain, no gain. Surgery. Sometimes you have to go through a tremendous amount of pain to get healed of some kind of ailment. And so not all pain is bad, and not all pleasure is good. There's a lot of people that are into sadomasochism that either inflicting people with pain or receiving pain themselves brings them pleasure. Well, that's not good. It's a good way to kill yourself and your friend or supposed friend. But not all pleasure is good. In fact, certain serial murderers have admitted that they felt a tremendous amount of pleasure in killing the people that they killed, and that doesn't make what they did right. Right is the greatest good for the greatest number. Here's another view. Right is the greatest good for the greatest number. It's usually referred to as utilitarianism, but the greatest good for the greatest number. Greatest good for greatest number. It sounds real good. It sounds real nice until you really look into it a little further. John Stuart Mill and was a utilitarian, but the reputation about this is, first off, you got to ask, well, what is good? You see, these guys are trying to define what is good, and they're telling you, well, what is good is the greatest good for greatest number. That'd be like saying, well, give me a definition of boxer. And a guy defines it as a boxer is a boxer who hits other guys. And it's like, well, you're using the word that we don't know what the word means. You can't use it in the definition. So you can't define good by using good in the definition as well and saying, well, what is good is the greatest good for the greatest number. Well, somebody here has to have an agenda and define what good is. I mean, if you talk to the communists, the greatest good for the greatest number is the world, is have communism take over the world and force communism down everybody's throat, and eventually we'll get this utopian society and they'll find out that we were right all the time. Whereas the greatest good for the greatest number, with a capitalist, it would be a totally different view. He would say the free enterprise system would be the greatest good for the greatest number, rather than a welfare state. So it doesn't really answer anything. It doesn't define what good is. It just assumes that we are the intellectuals. We know what the good is. We're the politically correct, if you will. And therefore, what we say the greatest good is for the greatest number, that's what the right is. Also, we can't accurately predict the future. What might be, even if we can figure out what the greatest good for the greatest number is now, we can't accurately predict the future, and that might blow up in our faces tomorrow, or 10 years from now, or 100 years from now. So it's just too vague. It almost says nothing. Aristotle said that what is right is what is desirable for its own sake. What is desirable for its own sake. Maybe they're right on the board here. He views moral values as an end, not as a means to an end. In other words, don't be kind to others just to get yourself rich. You say, well, if I be kind to all these people and be nice to them, when I need money, they'll start giving me money and it'll be a good way for me to get rich. Aristotle said, no, you be kind for the sake of being kind. So right is what is desirable for its own sake. But the reputation is it doesn't really define what is good. It just says good is what is good, what is good for its own sake. We often desire what is evil. The end doesn't justify the means, is what it amounts to. So just because you desire something for its own sake, like you could say, well, I desire to be kind just because I desire to be kind. Well, Ted Bundy might desire to be ruthless just because he desires to be ruthless. That doesn't make it right. G.E. Moore, here's a good one. Right is indefinable. Rabbi taking that, there's no way to distinguish right from wrong. When a guy, he can make the statement, he could say, okay, right is indefinable, and some guy could just run up from the crowd, jump on the stage, and punch him right in the nose. And now, if you can't define that as evil, you got a problem with your philosophical thought. I mean, it's pretty obvious if somebody punches you in the nose that what he did was wrong. And if your system says the right is indefinable, I think you're just talking a talk that you can't walk, because obviously he'd call the cops on a guy like that. But there's no way to distinguish right from wrong with that type of definition. And finally, the Christian view is good is what God wills. Now, I want to say something here, though, because we've got to understand this rightly. I would take the Geisler view, which would be more the Thomas Aquinas or the Augustine view, as opposed to the Gordon Clark view. And all those three guys that I mentioned there, they're all Christians. Good is what God wills. Okay? However, everything that God wills, He wills in accordance with His good nature. Good is what God wills, but everything that He wills is in accordance with His good nature. His will flows from His nature. Okay? God Himself is the ultimate authority or standard for what is good. Again, I'm saying the same thing in just different words. Christian ethics, it's based on God's will. Ethics, God never wills something contrary to His good nature. If God willed something, okay, now listen real close here. If God wills something because it is good, what a lot of people will argue is that therefore then there is something above God. Good is a standard that is above God. God wills something because it is good, then the standard of what is good is above God. However, if it's good because God wills it, then it makes good arbitrary. God just went eeny, meeny, miny, moe, the eenies and the meenies were good, and the minies and the moes were bad. Okay, do you understand what I'm coming at? So in other words, it seems to be a dilemma that there's no answer for it, but the answer for it is that the standard, there is no standard above God. God is the standard. God is good. God is good by His nature. And so God wills something, and He wills, it doesn't arbitrarily will it, and then that makes it good. Well, it's good because God said it. God willed it, so it must be good. But God wills it because it is good, but the only reason why it is good is because it's in accordance with His good nature. I don't know if everybody's following me or not, but it solves the a real major dilemma in philosophy that is raises an objection against Christianity. Now, Gordon Clark takes the other view. He was a Christian. He died, but that's why I say he was a Christian. But he takes the view that it's good because God wills it. So in other words, God pretty much went eeny, meeny, miny, moe. In other words, in Gordon Clark's thinking, it was possible for God to have created a world in where He would have made murder good and love evil. And I think that's about as far from the truth of the Bible as you can get. I think God wills something because it is good, but that good is not a standard above God. God is the standard, because God, whatever God wills, He wills in accordance with His good nature. Okay? God's will flows from His nature. A few things about Christian ethics we already talked about. Number one is based on God's will. And again, God's will, God never wills something contrary to His good nature. Secondly, Christian ethics is absolute. God's nature does not change. We find that in Malachi chapter 3, verse 6, and 1 Samuel 15, 29, that He who is the glory of Israel does not lie or change His mind, or He's not a man that He should change His mind. God's nature does not change, and therefore the moral obligations, God's commands, are always binding everywhere and on everyone. Now, He may also give temporary commands, like the Old Testament commands that were given just for the nation of Israel at a particular time, Old Testament sacrifices. But I'm not talking about when He gives temporary commands. I'm talking about when God makes moral commands, or He writes His laws in the conscience of a man, His moral obligations are always binding everywhere on everyone. That's what we mean by absolute. It's not like, murder is wrong in this case, but it's not wrong in that case, or whatever, stuff like that. We're going to get to how we resolve moral dilemmas a little bit later, but just keep in mind at this point, Christian ethics is absolute, okay? We'll get a little bit later in this lecture, we'll handle the moral dilemmas, which, well, that raises up a whole lot of questions there as well. But Christian ethics is also based on God's revelation. God's revelation. There's God's revelation in nature, which is called natural or general revelation. General because it's given to all men. Romans chapter 1 and chapter 2. So God reveals the invisible God reveals His existence and His power to us through the created universe. The invisible God reveals Himself to us through the visible universe that He has created. Also, He's written His laws on our hearts and in our consciences, Romans chapter 2, verses 14 and 15. But that is also supernatural revelation, which is also referred to as special revelation, where God revealed Himself to man through the Bible. It's special because not everybody has read the Bible. And of course, the fullness of God's supernatural revelation culminated when God became a man, the person of Jesus Christ. But through natural and supernatural revelation, God's Christian ethics are revealed to us, and of course, much more clearly in supernatural revelation than in natural revelation. Christian ethics is prescriptive, like, you know, like when you talk about like prescriptive drugs, drugs that have to be prescribed. Christian ethics are prescriptive, not descriptive. In other words, if the Christian ethic is descriptive, all it would say is it would just describe what is, you know. And so, if you murder people, it would just say, well, it's just describing what you're doing. You're murdering people, but it's not. I'll give you an example of these prescriptive laws are the laws of nature. The law of gravity doesn't prescribe what must happen. It describes what usually does happen, so that if somehow Jesus supernaturally gets around the law of gravity and ascends to heaven, the laws of nature are not prescriptive, so that they cannot rule out the possibility of an ascension into heaven. Instead, they're descriptive of the natural way things occur. But if there is a God, this God can supernaturally intervene and do something a little different. And so the laws of nature are descriptive. They describe the usual way things occur, but they can't rule out miracles because they're not prescriptive. However, ethical laws don't describe the way things are. They prescribe how things ought to be. Okay? They prescribe how things ought to be. And that's the main difference there. Christian ethics are God prescribing what is right, what ought to be, rather than describing the way things are. Okay? Christian ethics is deontological. Well, all we mean by that, these are nice words that you'll probably see on a test, these two words that I'm going to put on there. By deontological, the rule determines what is right. Okay? That's the deontological ethics. Okay? The rule determines what is right. Thou shalt not kill and you go out and you murder somebody. The rule determined that that action was wrong. Okay? So, then there's teleological ethics, where the result, now this comes from the Greek word telos, which means the end, the goal, the result determines what is right. This is also referred to as pragmatism. Whatever works is right. You know, if killing all your political enemies gets you elected to office, then it's right. You know, that type of thing. A lie will often work. Sometimes a doctor will tell a guy, well, you got about a 99% chance of pulling through this operation, so you're going to do just fine. Then the doctor goes and takes his relatives aside and says, well, I'm just telling him that he's got about a 40% chance of making it, but we need him to feel confident, so I lied to him. Well, if it works, it builds the guy's confidence up, and it works, and the guy pulls through, it doesn't make the statement true. It was still a lie. So just because it worked wouldn't make it true. Yeah?
Would you put the new thing in school, the older thing that's going on, experience under teleological?
What area, though, are you talking about?
Well, like in theology, where it's not what the Bible says, it's what your experience tells you is right.
Kind of neo-orthodoxy, like with Karl Barth, where it's not the words of the Bible, but it becomes the Word of God to you when you have an existential encounter with it.
Like Barbara Larson's doing a lot of things he's doing, not in Scripture, but his experience shows him that it's right.
Oh, guys kind of interpret the Scriptures with their experience rather than interpret their experience. Yeah, there's more of a pragmatic and teleological emphasis there. I wouldn't say that one word would cover everything that's going on, but yeah, there is that emphasis there. And it's an unhealthy emphasis as well. Let me see. Okay, so that's basically the Christian view of ethics there. There's six main views that Geisler touches on. Six major ethical systems that he devotes a chapter to each. And the emphasis where I want this course to go, I don't want to spend that much time on them, so I'm going to try to just finish up this lecture with these. And, pretty much you have, there's really only two real groups, relativism, moral relativism, or ethical relativism, or absolutism, moral absolutism, where this says that there are moral absolutes that are absolutely true, and this other group says, no, it's more relative, they're not always true and all. Something could be right one time and wrong another time, that type of thing. There's three different groups under this, and three different groups under moral absolutism, and three different groups under moral relativism. Under moral relativism, there's first antinomianism, just means against the law or no law. And what antinomianism teaches is that there are no moral laws. Lying, we'll give you an example of lying throughout in this section. Lying is neither right nor wrong. If you tell a lie, it's neither right nor, there's no such thing as right and wrong. So you get right, this is moral relativism in its purest form. What's right for you is right for you. It doesn't have to be right for me, and vice versa. You do whatever you feel like doing. Okay, and a little political comment there. I'll probably get sued. Okay, situation ethics. Some people would put situation ethics on this side because there is one moral absolute. Okay? But I think Geisler does a good job in showing that whenever you have one moral absolute that is so vague that nobody even knows what it is, that's the same for all practical purposes. That's being about as relative as you can be. So I put situational ethics under moral relativism. It says there is only one absolute moral law, and that law is love. But love is never really defined. It's not specified. And so what Joseph Fletcher, who came up with this view, situation ethics, he said that ethics are relative to the situation. Okay? He gives the example of a woman who's in a concentration camp, and the only way that she can get released from this concentration camp is if she's pregnant. And she wants to get back home to her husband and her family. And so what she does, she realizes one of the prison guards is attracted to her. So she tempts him, and he has sex with her, she gets pregnant, she gets released, and Joseph Fletcher says that's not wrong because it was right relative to that particular situation. So the situation determines what is right and what is wrong, but the overriding principle is love. That's what Joseph Fletcher would say. Here, though, that would make lying, that would say lying is sometimes right because the situation decides. Now, let me say this. That is off the wall. That is false, a false view. However, it comes very close to what I think the biblical view is, but he makes certain statements that just throws the whole ball of wax out. We'll get to that a little bit later when we get to Geisler's view, which was also Thomas Aquinas' view, and it's the view that I hold to as well. First time I heard it, it freaked me out, but just have a little patience when we get to that point. The third is generalism. Generalism teaches there are no moral absolutes. However, there are certain laws that are general, that in a general sense are right. In other words, they're not absolute laws, but lying is generally wrong. Most of the time, lying is wrong. Not all the time, but most of the time, it's wrong. Okay? So the command, thou shalt not bear false witness, is generally, to violate that command would be wrong, but not always. And so that's another view that falls under relativism. Under absolutism, you have three different views. There's unqualified absolutism, which basically teaches that the absolute moral laws never conflict, therefore lying is always wrong. Can anybody tell me why there would be a problem with that based on the Bible? The view that lying is always wrong.
Well, like the children of Israel, when the children burned that town, and they wanted to kill the ladies and hit them on the roof.
Rahab the harlot. Exactly. That's the primary case. There's other cases as well. There are times when God, throughout the Bible, God compliments Rahab the harlot for lying. She didn't submit to the governing authorities in Canaan. She lied to the government officials, so she lied, and she did not submit to the governing authorities, and God compliments her for that throughout. Now, if unqualified absolutism is true, lying would always be wrong. God should never compliment her for it. Now, what did she do? She was saving the lives of two innocent, godly Jewish spies, two godly Israelite spies at that time, by lying. She said, yeah, they came here, but they left, they went that way. Then after the government officials went in the direction she pointed, she let these guys down from the roof, and then they went out in the opposite direction. So unqualified absolutism seems to conflict with certain scriptures. Then there's the view that he calls, Geisler calls conflicting absolutism, or sometimes absolute commands conflict with one another. They contradict each other. And this is also called the lesser evil view. What God would command you to do then in that case, you would do the lesser of two evils, and then you would ask God for forgiveness. So in other words, Rahab the harlot would lie, save the lives of these two innocent guys, and then would ask God for forgiveness because she sinned when she lied. Okay? Problem with that is it seems like Jesus then would have committed lesser evils as well. The commandments, the Ten Commandments, say that you should not work on the Sabbath. Jesus worked on the Sabbath to heal people. Never once did he deny that he worked on the Sabbath. In fact, he admitted he worked on the Sabbath. He was saying, my Father's working till now, so I'm working till now. And we're going to see that Jesus did not claim he was doing the lesser of two evils. We're going to see that Jesus claimed he was doing the greater of two goods. It is good not to work on the Sabbath, but it is a greater good to heal on the Sabbath. And he brought up several, and this is what this is called too, is graded absolutism. Graded absolutism, or the greater good doctrine. And so whereas conflicting absolutism would say lying is always wrong, but it's forgivable, God will forgive you for lying if it's a lesser of two evils, graded absolutism will say even though God's laws are absolute, there are no exceptions. This is real key here. There are no exceptions, but at times there are exemptions. Okay? In other words, bearing false witness is wrong. Allowing innocent life to die when you could have prevented it is wrong. But when what you have to do, you obey the greater good, save innocent life, and God gives you an exemption from this absolute command. I think that's what Jesus, when they asked Jesus, you know how Jesus stumped them, he told them, he said, he talks about in John 7, verse 23, Matthew 12, verses 1 to 8, when he was healing on the Sabbath. But Jesus told them, told the Pharisees, Jewish religious leaders, he said, don't you guys, if you got an ox that's caught in a ditch, don't you remove him and free him, even if it's on the Sabbath day? Then he said, what if the eighth day of a child's life, of a boy's life, falls on the Sabbath day? Don't you circumcise him? You do the work of circumcision. Why? Because circumcision is greater than the law to keep the Sabbath, because circumcision introduces a Jewish child to the whole law, whereas keeping the not working on the Sabbath is only one portion of the law. So he says, if the eighth day of that child's life falls on the Sabbath day, you circumcise them. And so you work on the Sabbath. Why? Because you see two of God's commands coming in conflict. You can't obey them both, so you obey the greater law, and you receive an exemption from the lesser law. And so I would agree with Geisler that graded absolutism is the view that I would hold to. We're going to finish this discussion. We're a little over time right now. We'll finish it in the next lecture.